This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The violence has ebbed in Ferguson, Missouri, and peaceful protests over the weekend have given way to the funeral today of Michael Brown, a black 18-year-old who was shot and killed by a white police officer more than 2 weeks ago. Brown's death has raised a lot of questions in America about race and racism. It has also brought questions about how police are trained to react in volatile situations, situations where a suspect may or may not be armed, and situations where their own racial biases could come into play. Today on the program, we're going to spend some time looking at how Vermont's police officers are trained in a number of different areas, and whether they're learning and maintaining appropriate instruction. If you have a question about what kinds of training police officers here receive, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined for this discussion by Rick Gauthier. He's executive director of the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Center, which runs the Vermont Police Academy in Pittsford. Rick Gauthier, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
We're also joined today by Rutland Police Chief Jim Baker. Chief Baker, nice to have you back on the program as well.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be here.
And later on in the program, we're going to be hearing from Alan Gilbert, who's head of the ACLU of Vermont. But let's jump right in with a little bit about the training that police officers receive. And because it's been so much on the minds of people, I want to ask you, Rick Gauthier, when is it appropriate for a police officer to use a firearm?
Well, generally, it's to protect yourself or others from serious bodily injury or death. Aside from that, it's generally not the appropriate tool.
So what's the protocol?
Well, the protocol that we instruct here at the Academy is we use the AOJ, the Ability, Opportunity, and Jeopardy. And we have a fairly rigorous firearms training course that not only is designed to build proficiency with the firearm, but is also meant to give the recruit decision-making skills on when it's appropriate to use and when it's not. When I refer to Ability, Opportunity, and Jeopardy, that refers to, does your opponent have the ability to harm you? Is the opponent have the opportunity to harm you, and are you in jeopardy?
When when a police officer is pulling out a firearm and using it, what are they aiming for? What's the goal? Incapacitation? Killing?
Basically, it's to shoot to stop.
And where do they shoot towards? I mean, you shoot to the largest mass of the body, is that correct?
Center mass, that's correct.
So there's not, the aim is not to kill, but the aim is also not to specifically not kill. You're not trying to maim somebody. You're not trying to hit them in the knee, for example.
Correct.
Chief Baker, when a police officer is actually in a situation that might call for deploying a weapon, that's probably a pretty volatile, pretty hectic situation. How are officers trained to stay calm and to know what to do in what could be a very chaotic environment?
You know, Jane, that is one of the most difficult situations that a police officer faces. For those of us that have been in the business for a long period of time, it's not an easy decision. It's a very stressful situation. You know, the end result when there is a tragedy is very stressful for officers even after the fact. And I think, you know, the way that you address that, and, you know, I'll go back to my former role that Rick is in at the Academy. There's a lot of discussion in the state amongst even law enforcement about the way training is done at the Academy and the paramilitary environment. But the ironic part of it is, that in order for officers to be able to react under that kind of stress, there has to be a huge level of discipline built into the training process in order for them to adequately react when the situation presents itself.
So when you're saying that they need to have a sort of a rigorous, I mean, are you saying that military training is what allows them?
I'm not saying military training. It's a paramilitary model. You know, that puts officers under stress to see how they react under stress in order to program themselves when they're under stress.
Okay.
And so it's not military training.
Sure.
It's a paramilitary model. But stress training is a big part of that because those are very stressful situations. It's a split-second decision that has to be made. And in many cases, it's not only the officer's life, but it could be a fellow or sister officer's life or a civilian's life that's in jeopardy when the officer is presented with that situation.
So since we're talking about training today, Chief Baker, can you give me an example of that kind of stress training that officers are put under when they're at the academy?
Well, I think, first of all, it begins with the ability to introduce stress at various points in the training period. But also, you know, I know that under Rick's leadership at the academy, the level of stress-induced firearms training has gone up significantly. And there's been a review of the firearms training and, you know, what the requirements are. Even for the instructors, the bar has been raised. And it's all based upon this concept of, you know, there has to be the ability to train people under those stress conditions to react properly when confronted with that threat in the field.
We're talking today about the training police officers receive in Vermont and what that looks like, what kinds of training there is, various different types of training that officers get. We're also going to be looking at the different kinds of training that full-time officers get versus part-time law enforcement in Vermont. Listeners, if you have a question about this, you can post your question on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're going to move on to other topics within this training discussion, but before we leave firearms and situations where firearms might be deployed, we got a note from a listener who says, I'd like to know what kinds of circumstances justify police to shoot at someone. Last year, a mentally ill man wielding a shovel in Burlington was shot and killed by officers. I have read, this listener says, that regulations allow police to shoot to protect him or herself or another person from what the officer reasonably believes to be an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury. If a shovel is considered a deadly enough object to justify killing someone, then it seems to me that almost any object can be considered a deadly weapon. Can't police be given some kind of defensive training and things like shields so they can subdue someone like this without getting hurt and by avoiding deadly force? Rick Gauthier, what about that?
Well, I'm not going to comment on that specific shooting because I'm not familiar with it, with the specifics, but in general, a shovel can be a deadly weapon. There are any number of blunt impact or edged type tools that can be deadly weapons, and a lot of it depends on the facts that confront the officer at the scene at the time. And that's a decision that the officer has to make, given the totality of the circumstances, and whether or not that particular item or implement as a deadly weapon.
So this listener was also asking about other things, other kinds of protection that police officers might have, like shields. Do they have that kind of defensive protection?
Not that I'm aware of. Most of the tools that the officer has available to him or her are the ones that can be either carried on their belt or taken fairly easily from the cruiser at the time.
Chief Baker, are there enough shooting ranges for police to practice at in Vermont?
Yes, I believe there are. I believe we have adequate access to them. You know, it is difficult with new regulations around lead contamination and those type of things to find ranges. But at least in my case, we have a range. We have our own range, and we have access to the academy. Jen, I'd like to just go back to the comment about, you know, the shield, and I think this is sometimes the misconception that public has. Every one of these, and I'm not going to comment on the Burlington shooting because I don't know enough about it or the facts, but, you know, I do know after 40 years of being in this business that every one of these situations is different, and you can't anticipate everything that's going to happen at a viable situation. So, you know, agencies may have access to a shield, but the shields are not necessarily carried in the car. They may be back at a station. And if you know you're going to that situation, then, you know, you may be able to be equipped. But if you find yourself in a situation where you didn't anticipate it going the way it went, it's very difficult to bring everything with you that you think you're going to need.
And Rick Gauthier, just before we leave, going back now again to that idea of shooting practice, target practice, how do police officers and law enforcement officers maintain their skills in that realm?
Well, it's a requirement to maintain your certification in Vermont that you have firearms training every year. Up until recently, however, that was not regulated statewide. Last year, the council adopted a standardized 52-round training course that we not only use here at the academy for new recruits, but that officers are expected to certify on every year in the field. And the other improvement we made was extending the same firearms training to individuals in the part-time certification class as the full-time class, so that everybody that walks out of here with a certification, either full-time or part-time, has to meet the same standards.
Let's go to the calls. Bruce is on the line with us from Shelburne. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much, and thanks for picking up this topic. My question had to do with the increased training that's going on, if there's any attention being given to cultural factors that can come into play in a stressful situation. So, for example, you know, one policeman's ability to read a situation as aggressive, another person might see that merely as a demonstration or an expression of anger. Is there any work done with police to help them understand the difference between different kinds of situations, different cultural contexts?
Thanks for the question, Bruce. Rick Gothier?
There's instruction in fair and impartial policing, and that's side-by-side with a cultural awareness block of instruction. And then those sorts of lessons are reinforced with the recruits under different scenarios as they make their way through the academy.
So you're talking here about academy training. Let's just briefly go over that so people have a sense of what you're talking about. There is a 16-week course of instruction for full-time officers. Do all full-time police officers in Vermont have to go to the academy for that 16-week training program?
They do. Everybody has to go through the 16-week program unless they're waiving in a full-time certification from another state. But if they're getting brand-new certification, they have to go through the 16-week program. And depending on agency affiliation or training the officer may have had prior to starting that, there's also a 3-week pre-basic for the state police and up to 4 weeks post-basic in various topics.
Jim Baker, Chief Baker, maybe you can go into that a little bit, too. What officers are learning in that 16-week program? I understand there's an hour of physical activity and training every day. Rick Gothier mentioned the cultural awareness training that they're receiving. What kinds of activities and training are officers learning?
Well, first of all, it's heavy academics. You know, one of the things that's very challenging, and I'm not speaking for Rick, but, you know, being in his chair and being at the academy, you know, there's a lot of mandated training, but there's also a lot of training that focuses on issues that are high liabilities for localities. So when you talk about deadly force and proper arrest and the issue of fair and impartial policing and how to deal with folks that have mental health challenges, there's a lot of mandatory training that goes on. So there's the physical fitness piece, the hands-on training such as, you know, the driving school, which is a high-risk area for law enforcement from civil lawsuits. And, you know, there's the classroom piece, and then there's the hands-on piece. And to go back to the fair and impartial training, I think, to go back to the caller's point, not only is it a piece about cultural, but also there's a lot of effort going in today to response to domestic violence and folks who have mental health challenges and the disabled are all part of the training curriculum that's at the academy. And then it's not only classroom, but then it's practical, hands-on, taking the classroom experience and applying it to a real-life scenario.
So, Chief Baker, as training theory and methodology changes, you know, as these different pieces come into the academy, are officers who come out of the academy today learning different skills and different ways of being a police officer than those who are still on the job but got their initial training 30 years ago?
Well, I think Rick and I can talk about old guys being around for a long time, Jane. Entirely different today. You know, I just got a couple of folks out of the last class here at Rutland City Police Department. It's much more about public safety. It is quote-unquote policing and providing public safety to a community. And it's also a focus on, you know, some of the issues that bring us to this conversation around mental health challenges, cultural issues. I think the academy is doing an outstanding job exposing people to that. This younger generation comes out of the academy much better prepared to deal with those scenarios than when I came out of the academy in 1978.
We're hearing from many people with thoughts today as we talk about the training that law enforcement officers receive and some questions that people have. Christopher wrote in to say, as a police officer, my first job is peacekeeper. I'm committed to protecting people from harming one another and sometimes themselves. Understanding that I may be the control that they may lack, and my use of physical force, tasers or pistol, are counter to my prime objective. These methods are truly a last resort. Shasta says, policing a community means being able to communicate with and serve all of its members. Especially in Chittenden County, law enforcement needs to be cognizant of our diverse population and take a mindful approach. Let's go to Steve, calling in from Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
You're on the air.
Oh, I just had a comment, you know, with the, you know, the deadly force issue. You know, being a former retired police officer and SWAT team member, and I've done extensive training with police officers, you know, every single officer is different. We're all built different. You know, and we have female officers, and I'm not saying anything bad about female officers because I've worked with a bunch of them that have been absolutely incredible. But they have different strengths and different weaknesses. And if you take a police officer who is, you know, 5'8" and weighs 140 pounds, and you put him up against, he's trying to effect an arrest on a guy that's, you know, 6'2", 6'3", and weighs 280, and a fight ensues, he may be more apt to pull his sidearm to protect his life than another police officer would.
And you think that's okay, Steve?
I guess my point is, just from my experience, in order to make a comment, you actually have to be out there on the street, be in that physical fight where you're fighting for your life. You know, the main goal of any police officer is to go on his shift and to go home safe to his family.
Yeah, I hear you, Steve, and I hear what you're saying. Let me put that to Rick Gothier, because, you know, Steve is saying, look, there are police officers, not only do they have different strengths, but there are different body types, there are different abilities. Is that something that's taken into consideration when it comes to something like what the protocol is in a given situation?
Well, we teach, along with the firearms course, we teach a use of force and tactics that incorporates hands-on, incorporates the use of an impact weapon, and incorporates pepper spray. So there are a number of tools that are available to the officer, and the goal is to give the officer the appropriate tool to use depending on the circumstances that he or she is facing at the time. Now, whether or not something about the officer themselves might influence a choice one way or the other, that's what we train here at the academy. Everybody has to pass at the same standard. That includes large recruits, small recruits, male recruits, female recruits. So when they leave here, they're all proficient to at least the minimum level and above. So I guess the question that would kind of present itself after that is, what's done afterwards to maintain that conditioning in the field?
Are they required to maintain conditioning in the field? Do you have to recertify in your athletic training, for example, every year?
Just the firearms. The agencies vary as to whether or not they have PT requirements. We have PT requirements to enter here, but that's to take part in the training. A lot of agencies in Vermont don't have any continuing physical testing standards. There's a variety across the state, but most of the officers, even if their agency doesn't have that requirement, I'd say the majority of them take it upon themselves to stay in some sort of shape.
And let's go to John calling in from Berlin. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm calling in regards to the use of these urban assault vehicles and how many exist in Vermont and under what conditions and training is involved in using these vehicles. Thank you.
John, thanks for your call. And John brings up a point that's been much in the news and in people's conversations lately, especially since the events in Ferguson, Missouri, where the police officers had military equipment, and so surplus military equipment going to police departments has been a big issue. Jim Baker, I'm going to turn this to you, and not because I know whether Rutland has this equipment or not, or because you could comment on Colchester, but because this is something that people are talking about, militarization of police forces and surplus military equipment, I hope maybe you can address that.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, here in Rutland, we don't have any of that type of equipment. We do have flak vests and equipment to protect the officers. You know, Jane, one of the things I'd like to point out before I get to that is that, you know, within this discussion that's going on nationally, we have to recognize that right now, nationally, for the first 6 months of this year, there's been a 67% increase of the killing of police officers with firearms in the country compared to 2013. You know, our obligation as police leaders is to the community, but we also have an obligation to our employees to provide them with the training and equipment to protect them and keep them safe. And so the balance that we have to put into place is, how do you deploy this equipment that's being talked about nationally? And I think in Vermont, I'll go back to my state police days, there was a decision made when this money started coming into the state a number of years ago that the equipment would stay at the state level, and that the majority of the chiefs and sheriffs have agreed in the state that equipment will be maintained at the state level, and with some checks and balances on how it's deployed. And so for us here in Rutland, we don't have any of that type of equipment. I think there's very few agencies in the state that have any type of equipment like that. You know, the state police maintain that equipment for the purposes of providing it in a timely fashion when we need it. The balance we have to keep here is that when you deploy that equipment, it's deployed properly and not deployed in an improper manner. But again, you know, just in recent incidents, you know, the state police had an incident in Addison County a couple months ago where two police officers were fired on. You have to balance and understand that we have to protect our officers, and we need the equipment to be able to do that. But we as leaders need to understand when you deploy that, it needs to be deployed properly and with respect to the citizenry that you police.
That's Jim Baker. He's the chief of police in Rutland. Chief Baker, thank you for talking with us again. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane.
We're talking about the training that police officers get in Vermont, both initially and in an ongoing capacity. Lots to talk about. We're not going to get to it all, but we're trying to touch on many topics today and hear from some of you with your questions about the kind of training that officers receive. You can ask a question by posting it at vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Rick Gauthier, who runs the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Center, is going to stay with us, and we'll be speaking with the head of the ACLU in Vermont about what concerns civil rights advocates have about law enforcement training. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're gaining insight into what kind of training law enforcement officers in Vermont get. We've heard from many of you with your thoughts, concerns, and support. Steph writes, policing is all about community service and protection, not militarization. Mark says, why are we expecting police to be more perfect than the rest of us? Yes, I understand they have more responsibility, but they're still human. Paul says potential police officers should have a complete psych workup before they're hired. And Jim thinks that police officers should get more target practice. You can share your questions or thoughts about police training. If you want to just comment, you can go to vpr.net, share your thoughts with us there. You can also call 1-800-639-2211. Rick Gauthier is Executive Director of the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Center, which runs the Vermont Police Academy. He's with us today, and we're joined now by Alan Gilbert. He's Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Vermont. Alan Gilbert, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
So I'd just like maybe your preliminary thought here on what's one area of training that you would like Vermont officers to focus more on?
The most immediate area is taser training, because there was a bill passed by the legislature this past year that will require there to be consistent standards for training and use of tasers across the state. We're actually spending a lot of time now working with Rick Gauthier and others at the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council on some of the policies and the collection of data that will be used. When I was listening to the beginning of the show, two thoughts came to mind. The first is that there, sort of the small picture is, I think we would all agree there are certain policies that need to be looked at to see if they're really up to date and whether they can be made more consistent around the state. Tasers is one, but I know the use of force policy that's used in different departments around the state has been identified as another one that we should be paying more attention to. There's the bigger picture, too, and for us, that's the need, we think, for the licensing of police in this state. Police are one of a few professions who aren't licensed. We license about 45 professions in the state, from tattoo artists to teachers to doctors and lawyers, but police are not licensed. They're certified after they complete the training at the academy, but there's not the same kind of regular check-in and rigor and making sure people are up to date with their education and the issues they're facing with when they're on the job that you have in other professions, and we think that should change.
Rick Gauthier, would you support that?
Well, Alan and I have had some fairly lengthy conversations.
Yes, we have.
And what he's calling certification, in many instances, is licensing. But there are other elements that can be added to that. One of the proposals that we've talked about, for example, is in addition to completing the 16-week course here, there are other elements that go along with getting a license. And the whole piece of maintaining ongoing professional standards, we have that to some effect, to some degree now, with the minimum number of hours that individuals have to get training every year to maintain their certification. And some of that is mandated, and some of that is optional, up to the agency preference. But could it be better? Certainly. One of the things that Al and I have talked about quite often is decertification. What do you do when you have an officer that, for whatever reason, is either exhibiting bad conduct or isn't rising to the standards of the profession? And I think Alan would agree that we're certainly trying to do much more within the parameters we have, and we're trying to expand the parameters even as we speak. In other words, under what conditions can a law enforcement officer be decertified in the state? So it's an ongoing process. Now, maybe the end result is some sort of licensing structure, but I think the other pieces have to be put in place before we get there.
I want to move to another topic that's of concern to a lot of Vermonters, and it comes up frequently when we do shows like this. We got a note from Barbara who says, in larger cities, some police departments have a trained cadre of officers in the particular problems of policing individuals with a history of mental illness. In a small state like Vermont, the mechanics of arranging the properly trained individual's appearance at the right place and the right time would be nightmarish. She says, I'm concerned with the reports of aggressive policing in situations with the disturbed, and there has to be a better way. And at this point, I'd like to bring Kristen Chandler into the conversation. She's the Team 2 coordinator for the state, and she can explain what that means. But Kristen, can you address specifically mental health and policing and how police officers in Vermont are getting trained?
I can, Jane, and thank you for having me on the show. Team 2 is a statewide curriculum that was developed by the Department of Mental Health that focuses on collaboration between law enforcement officers and mental health crisis workers to make sure that there's a conversation there whenever there is a mental health crisis, whether it's by telephone or in person, where law enforcement is first, or if the mental health crisis workers are first on the scene, that they're talking to each other to provide a coordinated response and focusing on safety, the legal aspects, and the clinical aspects of every situation that might arise. So officers around the state right now and mental health crisis workers are receiving training. There will be 8 trainings in the next 10 months. We've already had one, and we have 2 scheduled in September in different regions around the state that focus on scenario-based training. They'll go through 3 different scenarios, practice those out together, come back and talk about them together with the group. And these trainings are all, they're facilitated by me, but they're done by fellow officers and fellow crisis clinicians who all received the training last May of 2013.
Kristen, thank you very much for telling us a little bit about it. I appreciate you calling in and addressing Team 2 training. Thank you for calling. I want to move to Alan Gilbert. Is that something that you're supportive of, that kind of training, and is that enough?
it's not enough because I'm not sure you can ever do enough. The situations are really difficult, and we appreciate the kinds of stresses that police officers have to bear on a daily basis. It's tough. I've been involved with what's called Act 80 training, which started about 10 years ago because of incidents involving mentally disturbed people, largely in Brattleboro at first. The Attorney General's office set up a task force to look at how training for police and dealing with people who are facing a mental health issue could be improved. Unfortunately, the incidents have continued. I think we're getting better in dealing with them. But we really think we've got to do more. That's why we keep focusing on licensing. We shouldn't wait until something happens to recognize that we need more consistent training. We have to mandate certain things. We have to make sure that people are kept up to speed on the latest developments in dealing with certain situations. And we think licensing would be a scheme that would help to do that.
Rick Gothier, I want to turn to you for one last topic here today, which is the issue of the training that part-time law enforcement officers receive in Vermont, which is significantly less, at least in initial training, than the 16-week police academy training that full-time officers receive. Do you think that that's a problem?
I do. That's one of the reasons that, one of the issues that 765 was designed to address.
This is a new law passed by the legislature in this past year.
Sorry, I didn't clarify that.
Sure.
Currently, the status quo is that an officer going through the part-time training has, in aggregate, about 198 hours of training, whereas an officer going through the full-time academy has anywhere from 840, I believe, up to probably close to 1,000 if they have pre-basic and post-basic. And the training that the full-timer gets includes the artificial stress designed to build in discipline. It includes a lot of scenario training, and it's put on by subject matter experts. And so there's a lot of hands-on. There isn't even a remote comparison between the two programs. However, upon completion, each one of them has the same level of authority. The only limitation on the part-time certified officer is that he or she can only work a maximum of 32 hours a week. So 765 sought to address that by introducing a cap on the scope of practice. And some of that is specified in the bill, and the rest of it, what the upper end looks like. Commissioner of Training is currently a project being undertaken by the council. We have to report back to the legislature, I believe, by January 15th of 2015.
Yeah, and the idea here is to come up with a recommendation for ways to have different training levels for part-time and full-time officers. Alan Gilbert, will that address any concerns that you have about the different levels of training?
It will help, but, you know, some of this rests on us as taxpayers. We have to own the fact that we're trying to do policing on the cheap. We really have to have people fully trained if they're going to have the same full authorities that full-time officers will have. I mean, this is an untenable situation where you have people operating at different levels of training but the same authority.
So what do you think? More money from towns? More money from the state?
Yeah, you really have to have full training for everybody. And again, we think licensing, looking at people's performance on a regular basis, is really necessary to have great policing.
But licensing, I mean, sure, that's one thing, but it sounds like what you're saying is that really you need more money, and a lot of it comes from town budgets if we're talking about the sheriffs, for example.
Yeah, the sheriffs are actually the county budget, I think, but I get your point.
Well, but towns contracting with sheriffs pay it out of a town budget.
Right. I think there's also a county assessment. But
sure.
The point is that I think Vermont for many years has tried to do policing on the cheap, and we really haven't had the coordinated system that we really need for statewide policy, statewide training, uniform responses. We really, if people think there's a lot of local control with schools, there's even more with police departments. And I think we have to get away from that and realize the responsibility is everybody's around the state to make sure that we have a really highly trained, consistently trained cadre of law enforcement officers out there protecting us.
Alan Gilbert is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Vermont, the ACLU of Vermont. Alan, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Rick Gauthier has been with us for this full discussion. He's Executive Director of the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Center, which runs the Vermont Police Academy in Pittsford. Rick Gauthier, thank you for being with us, too. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Listeners, you can carry on this conversation by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition. Coming up, we're going to peek in the windows of the home of famous recluse J.D. Salinger. His home is up for sale in Cornish, New Hampshire. This is Vermont Edition. Author J.D. Salinger was secretive and reclusive, and his neighbors in Cornish, New Hampshire guarded his privacy fiercely. So just about anything that gives us a peek into his world is of interest to those who loved his work. Recently, a home he once owned in Cornish, New Hampshire was put up for sale by its current owner. Salinger lived there for about 30 years, from the 50s to the 80s. Jane Dara is the real estate agent for the seller, and she joins us now from her office at Martha Diebold Real Estate in Hanover. Jane, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So how much interest are you getting for this Salinger, former Salinger home?
Well, we're getting a huge amount of interest on two levels. One is from the media, who love to talk about Salinger. And, you know, we've had calls from London papers and Esquire magazine and all sorts of people. And then at the other level is people who might possibly be interested in buying it.
Right, which is probably more important to you.
Which, well, it's probably more important to the seller, that's for sure.
The fact that Salinger lived there actually a selling point?
I think it is for some people. I mean, some people couldn't care less. And one person who I took to see the house, I told him Salinger lived there, and he said, "Who's that?" So, you know, it's all in your perspective. But I think, in general, people do have a fascination with fame.
But the sellers can't bump up the price by $200,000 or $300,000 just because Salinger lived there?
I don't think so, no. But when the bottom line comes to it, you have to get the bank to appraise it, so that's not going to work.
The bank doesn't care about Salinger. That's
not
the
even
real.
Slightly, yes.
Jane, could you give us a walkthrough of the home and what it looks like?
Yes, certainly. It's a very, very pretty setting, and it is very secluded. It incorporates land on both sides of the road, and the road is pretty much of a non-event, very small. You walk into the house into a big, well, not really big. None of the rooms is huge. It's not an enormous house at all. But into a family room, which is combined with the kitchen. And there's a fireplace, which is lovely. And off that, there is what could be a bedroom suite, presently being used as an office with a full bath off it. And then up half a dozen stairs to an enormous living room with exposed beams, kind of barny feeling rather than sophisticated. And there's a door from that living room into the garden, which is a beautiful spot with the lovely view of Mount Ascutney. And then upstairs to three bedrooms and a bath. So there are a total of two baths in the house. And then there's an apartment above the garage, which has another bath and another bedroom. And Salinger used to hang out a lot there, apparently, when he was on the outs with his wife.
He also built a tunnel.
He did build a tunnel from the basement of the house to the basement of the garage.
Was that connected also to when he was on the outs?
I don't know. I think the garage was the first thing that they built when they bought the property. So I'm not sure what the history is there.
So, Jane, how do you weed out the people who are just curious to get a peek at a home where this famous recluse lived from people who might actually want to buy the house and live in it?
Well, it's a fine line, but we're not interested in showings, you know, just for no real reason except curiosity. So really we just chat, and we chat quite a bit before we go and make sure that they're not just curiosity seekers. And the owner has also asked that nobody take any interior photographs other than our official professional photographer who was there. So I make that clear to people, too. So I think that pretty much discourages just the lookers.
Well, and if people want to have a look at the home, we'll put a link to your listing at vpr.net so people can get that sneak peek without having to call you. Who would be the right buyer for the Salinger house?
Well, probably I would think a couple. It's not a very big house. It's about 2,900 square feet. It has rooms that are on the small side. The bedrooms, for instance, I always think today people think their children need enormous bedrooms. It's as if they're minor royalty. And in those days, when this house was built in 1939, that was very definitely not the case. So I think probably a couple, because today everybody wants to have one guest room and two offices. So I think this house is ideally suited for that.
But it's not necessarily a starter home for a young couple just starting out. The asking price is $679,000.
That's right, which is beyond a great many young couples' reach, yes. So you'd have to want to be in the country. I could see it being a second home as well, because it is a beautiful spot to come to, and that, you know, the mountain view is just spectacular.
Jane, I understand that you're actually becoming something of a celebrity home seller, because earlier this year you sold a home that C. Everett Koop, the former Surgeon General, had lived in.
That's right. Realtor to the stars.
Is that something you've always aspired to?
No, it certainly isn't anything I've aspired to, but it adds a bit of humor, I guess, to the day.
So now people are going to come to you when they need to sell a home that has some special attributes or special previous owners and tenants. That's okay with you?
That's absolutely okay with me. I'd be thrilled.
Jane Dara is a real estate agent in Hanover, New Hampshire. She's been telling us about the former home of writer J.D. Salinger in Cornish. And as I said, we will post a link to the listing so you can peek in the house without having to call Jane Dara and annoying her. Jane, thank you very much for speaking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Stone walls cross the Vermont landscape, but building them has become something of a dying art. So that's what we're going to learn in today's installment of Summer School. Thea Alvin is a dry stone mason who lives on a small farm in Morrisville, which is adorned with stone walls and arches. She's our instructor today, and she says there's a mixture of skill and of creativity involved.
I always approach the wall as if it is a conversation. It's a dialogue between me and the stones. I look at all of them and see who wants to fit where and what space is open. And you're creating rows and levels and layers and details, just like a friendship would be, and relationships between each stone. And then you come to a final height, and that will want to be solid and stable. And just the way that you see a brick pattern with two bricks down and then one across the top, you do the same with the stones, two stones down and one across the top. And that's called bonding. So if you follow that pattern and additionally follow the pattern of going towards the interior of the wall, then you'll build a strong wall. I should use gloves. I don't use gloves. I love to feel the stone. I love how the stones feel. I feel like I communicate with them, and by touching them, I understand them better. I always start from the corner. When there's a corner on a double-faced stone wall, it's called the cheek end, and that will want to be nice and square and level, because that's what you're going to see. And the corner really drives what happens in the wall. So we'll put a nice 90-degree angle on this side. I think that there's a couple of square stones right here, and we'll use those for the cornerstones. The part of the wall that you see with your eyes is called the face. And when I build a wall, I always work on it with my face facing the face of the wall, like a conversation that you'd have. So if your wall has two faces and you're working on one side, you need to go all the way around to the other side to work on it face to face, because you really can't fix something if you're not looking at it. The wall itself needs to obey three rules: water, temperature, and gravity. So your stone wall as a structure wants to shed water. Water happens a lot, actually, in Vermont. And so we want the water to get out of the wall system. So the way that you arrange the stone needs to shed the water away. So ultimately, you want the stones that you're laying to be flat and level, or shed just a little bit out. So let's look at these stones. Each one of the stones has a face. It's got a top and a bottom. So each one of the stones that we pick up will want to be in the orientation where the face is on the front. Let's lay them out on this string line. So we have a straight line, and we can create a straight line of where the wall will be. We want to shape the stones if there's any little tips. Let's cut this part off of the stone right here because it doesn't fit well against the next one. I'm not going to cut on the front of it because I like the front to be really natural, but the back is too big on this side. So let's cut this part off. And then we can lay the stones out so that they're all in a straight line. When we build the wall, you have to put something behind it. What would you put behind it? Because otherwise you have a lot of weak, floppy stones. So let's put some more stones. Maybe that one that's not so pretty. It doesn't have much of a face on it. We'll tuck that one in the back. A dry stone mason is somebody who builds stone walls without mortar. And that's what I'm doing now, is building stone walls and stone sculptures without mortar. So that has been an evolution for the last 30 years, as I've learned to shed the mortar and just trust gravity.
That was Thea Alvin, a dry stone mason from Morrisville, who works and teaches her craft all over the world. VPR's Amy Noyes produced that summer school piece. And we are still getting notes from listeners about our earlier discussion about police training in Vermont and what questions you've had about that, as well as some comments about what police are learning and how they interact. Sean says a big problem is that police primarily interact with a narrow cross-section of society, people in a bad place and people outside of the law. He says most of their experience is with the worst of us, and also most citizens are law-abiding yet have mostly negative experiences with police. Police need to spend more time interacting positively with the larger community, which are overwhelmingly law-abiding. More of these positive experiences for both police and citizens will go a long way to resolving the tensions that currently exist. And that'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow, how to fire someone. It's not pleasant, but almost every company is eventually faced with letting someone go or laying off employees. We'll look at the right way to do it, both legally and ethically, and we'll also discuss what can be discussed publicly and what employees should do when a friend or coworker is let go. Send your questions or comments about getting fired to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.